open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
When the bomb maker comes home with explosive material inside of him, when the infantry soldier kicks in a door and frightens children, that journey seems singular in its scope, but really, you are at war. We are at war.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. On today's program, soldiers who write about experiences that outsiders to combat can find hard to understand.
There was one review that started off with, when I got this book, my thought was, just what we need, another crazy book from another crazy vet. And in some ways, that was exactly the point. I felt like I was turning into a stereotype and a caricature of myself.
Brian Kastner's book, The Long Walk, draws on his experience as the commander of an explosive disposal unit in Iraq. Poet and professor Brian Turner's memoir, My Life as a Foreign Country, retraces his time at war from deployment to combat, homecoming, and its aftermath. Kastner and Turner talk with former U.S. Marine Corps officer and actor Benjamin Bush, who is the author of the memoir Dust to Dust. Brian Turner starts off the program explaining the title to his book.
The title really comes from the idea of the separation from myself. It seems like there's a world where there's a country that I was, and I was a part of, and became part of me. And then there's another life that I have now. And there's a separation between them.
Is it also kind of true for your feelings about, you know, your childhood, and then what happens thereafter when you kind of gain more of these, what we consider to be adult experiences, though I don't consider, you know, experience to be limited to any particular age if you're paying attention, but do you in your book, it seems like you have, kind of like I felt when I was kind of looking at memoir, that there was a different time. It's a time before so many of those ideas of youth are destroyed. It's before anyone's dead. Yeah. Is that part of what you were thinking?
Well, what's strange to me is that even in childhood, looking back on it, I'm with you on that, but as I look back at the childhood, I see myself digging holes and digging foxholes and
right. This
kind of thing. And my dad had ranger handbooks and that kind of thing, so I could set my sector stakes and get my limit, left and right limits and put grenade sumps and the whole thing.
The grenade sumps was the one that impressed me.
Oh, nice. Right.
I felt so outclassed. I was like, I didn't have a ranger handbook, you know? But then, it's raged by hippies.
So the part of it, I know, right? The part of it is like me crawling out into the grass with there was no one out there in the grass, but in the imagination, the enemy was there. And the enemy was an inherited one that I didn't know, but I knew that was these ghosts from Vietnam, from World War II, that were out there in the grass.
Both of you place yourselves in history, and we'll talk, I'd like to get a couple sections from your book a little bit later on about kind of how you trace a history of these kind of experiences. And The Long Walk, obviously, is both a direct term for a bomb disposal technician, but also it's a long walk home, right?
Right.
Can you describe your title, please?
Sure. The title was my editor's idea, and there are some editors make a few key additions or help, I think, at certain points. When I sold the book, it was actually titled Running with Ricky, and Ricky is a character in the book who I basically speak to all throughout, and I thought Ricky was really a central part of the book. And my editors, when we were all done, and we were on line edits, we were down to just about, you know, the last little bit, he said, what about The Long Walk? And he kind of said it with this idea that, you know, like they had already made the cover and put the title on it, and like, this is what we've done. But of course, it does have two meanings. Bomb technicians, particularly in the United Kingdom, it's been called the long walk, the idea that you put on the bomb suit and you walk by yourself with nobody else to the IED, the improvised explosive device. You know, that's been a term in the career field for decades. But yeah, it is a very long walk home from the war, right? And I think, and that comes out great in Brian's book, where I wondered as I was reading it, like, what's this book getting to? What's it, where's the end coming? We keep coming home, and we keep coming home, and we keep coming home, and of course that's the whole point, right? Is that there's just this time of reabsorbing.
And Do you have any stories of, you know, I remember them as the war continued and as we tried to stay ahead of the threat with, specifically with improvised explosive devices, the disguises of these bombs continued to evolve. Right. How did they begin to get, I mean, can you give us kind of the transition? Like first they were just, they were artillery rounds on the side of the road.
Right,
and you'd
right.
Be a fool
just,
to miss it.
There's, I mean, they're out there and it's like, look at that thing. And people would go up to them and kick them and stuff. Like we weren't.
I didn't.
Well, that's good for you. But I mean, there wasn't this. I mean, we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into yet. And then they started hiding them first. And the big one was always the animal carcass, right? They would put it in a dead dog or a dead donkey or something, and then in a bag of trash because there's trash all over the country.
Everywhere, right.
Absolutely everywhere. But then we got pretty good at clearing all that kind of stuff off, and so then it was a pile of rocks. And then it wasn't a pile of rocks anymore, it was a hole in the ground, and they cover it with dirt. And then it was, they put it in the hole in the ground, and they cover it with dirt, and they pour it with water over it in the wet season, and they wait for the dry season. And the thing sits there for 6 months, and it looks exactly like any other crusted over dirt anywhere in the country. And so it got to a certain point, say by 06, 07, 08, where you just assumed that there was an IED everywhere and you were simply not going to find it. That if they really wanted to hide it, that there wasn't going to be a dog anymore. It was going to be completely hidden. And so then luck takes over. There's just, why step here and not there? There's no...
The randomness of death kind of consumes war, which is the hard part. After you train so long, you begin to have this gilded sense that because your skills and prowess are now at a level of competence, that it's given you an edge. And then the ground just disappears.
I have control.
They just pick
issues.
You.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you, if when I think military people in general, and especially bomb techs, type A control issue people like me, you plan on being in charge all the time. And of course, the only reason I'm taking apart this IED is because I'm smarter than everybody else. I'm smarter than the bomb maker. I'm smarter than the guy who tried to hide it. I'm the best person here to do this particular job. And when it really is random, you know, that's one of those mind jobs that you learn in war.
How does that Uber control work at home?
Oh yeah, great.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Hi, honey. I got it. I got all this.
I am not an easy person to live with, and God bless my wife and four sons, for sure. That for you're gonna clap. We can clap for my wife. she needs it.
I agree. You've both written about the veteran's journey to war and back. Why do we need these books, Brian? Why do we need these books about the journey? Why do we need to, from the actual perspective of the inside, the mind of the people who go forward, experience these events, which are, you know, created by their countries and then return to their countries?
Sure.
Why do you think it's important for the not just the narrative of the nation, but for people who aren't veterans to read this book? Because this is not just a veteran story. It's much wider and in scope and in beauty.
Thank you. I think for me personally, I had to write it first to try to understand some things, or at least come closer to things in my life and see some of the connections that weren't quite making sense to me right off the bat. But in terms of sharing it with other people, I think part of it is because when the bomb maker walks out towards this explosive material, when the bomb maker comes home with explosive material inside of them, when the infantry soldier kicks in a door and frightens children and takes all the men of military age away, when the sergeant with an English degree writes the depositions that puts them away, it's translated into Arabic and puts them into prison, maybe still in prison to this day, with the American flag on the shoulders of all of those going towards these events, I think that that journey seems singular in its scope, but really, you are at war. We are at war. And we are walking into their houses. We put people into prison. And trying to connect that, I feel I'm trying to share an indictment or a complicity that I feel in myself. And if it finds a home in someone else, good.
And for you?
I didn't know I was doing what you described. I thought that I was writing a really small story of something that just happened to me and to some of my friends. Hmm. In fact, I was so naive, I didn't even know that was called a memoir in the publishing industry.
Well, it's a French word.
Right, right. So back to Colbert. I thought a memoir was something you write at the end of your life when you know how everything was like turns out. And I didn't know how my life was going to turn out. I thought I was going crazy, right? So I just wrote this story. And the fact that other people would say, you know what, I felt the same way.
And families.
And families feel the same way. And I'll be honest, in most of my book events, I don't talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. I talk about, or people want to talk about, Vietnam.
Right.
And they want to talk about their sister who died of cancer. And they want to talk about when a friend got in a car crash. And it's these trials that we have in our life. And I think if you're really, really lucky, a book is two books. A book is the book you thought you wrote. And then the book is, when other people read it, it becomes whatever it turns into, right?
Right.
And one of the things that my book has turned into, at least for some people, is, hey, this veteran experience describes me too. I mean, it's extremely humbling. It's not what I intended when I got started, I guess. I had no idea.
Yeah. For both of you, what was the first writing that led to these books? You began as a poet, but you really weren't a writer, full time, although you had the urge very early on. What was kind of the first seed, which you wrote a piece and you were like, you know, this is just going to expand like a universe. This is something that I need to grapple with all the way.
I had this idea of writing to make sense of things, and of course, human beings, we tell stories to make sense of the world. And the very first time I tried that, I was getting out of the Air Force and I was moving from Las Vegas to Buffalo. Who does that, right? Moves from Las Vegas to Buffalo. And I thought that, who does this? This would be interesting to write about. And I wrote a little essay and I got it published in Newsweek, back when Newsweek was
still
a magazine,
yeah.
And had that My Turn column and for just outside essays. It only occurred to me later that not everybody just occurs to them to write an essay when something happens to them, right? And I had been writing a political column, which I'm glad I gave up. But I did have a moment where I thought, hey, this thing that's happening to me, other people might want to read it. And the very first section I wrote was the Kermit chapter right in the middle.
Mm. Which is interesting. It ends up being the center of the book.
I wrote the beginning, and then I wrote the end, and then I kind of wrote the stuff in between, and I moved it all over. I went in with, I'm going to write a book. And I started tracking type A control person again, tracking my daily word count and all that kind of stuff, and I was on the schedule.
And what was the, you had already had two books of poetry, a book that you put away because I threatened you over it.
That's a true story, but we'll get to that later. Yeah. With a grenade, no less. Yeah. You can see his handiwork, so you've got to take him seriously.
The grenade was a metaphor.
Yeah, well, you know, there really? Was Ted Genoways was previously with Virginia Quarterly Review,
right.
VQR, and he'd seen a couple of blogs that I'd done, New York Times kind of thing, just short pieces about connected to travel, and then he contacted me because he really, I got the Amy Lowell Traveling Fellowship, where they give you $50,000 and tell you to leave the country, you know,
yeah.
Which is not hard to do, you know. So, you know what I mean? You get that chance to travel.
And yeah, exactly.
They'll pay for you to go. It was amazing. And my wife and I, she got a half-year sabbatical that year, so we traveled together. And it seemed like every country I went to, it's the lens, of course, that I'm seeing the world through.
Sure.
I kept finding war or traces of war, echoes and the ruins, and among beautiful things, too, wonderful people and experiences. And so he sort of challenged me to write Haibun, and this sort of travelogue prose piece, sort of short prose passages that are end capped with a haiku, right? And I tried those. I mangled the form, but the experiment got about 90 pages worth of material about travel and war, and it was really confusing. I sent it to him, and then we weeded it down and whittled down to about 22 pages, which became this chapter called My Life as a Foreign Country.
Hmm.
And then I knew, like, a book announced itself.
And interesting.
Yeah.
Just very quickly, like one sentence. What was the hardest part of writing a book? Was it getting through to the end? Was it beginning? What was the hardest thing about creating an entire? I mean, look at that.
Like, it's not that big.
It is big. It's so much longer than a
the hardest,
poem. And
the
an
hardest
essay.
Part is. On a Tuesday in February, when you're 25,000 words in, like writing something. The writing's not hard, it's the feeling that you're making progress. And then the next day doing it again and doing it again and doing it again. Which is of course now my whole job, every day. But at the time, the first time, it was.
And how about a little story about the actual editing process? Once you thought you were done and you sent it to someone who said, about that.
Well, I mean, one thing was the title, but the other one, I think the main addition, and my editor would agree with this, the main addition is the amount that my wife is in there. And she was in there hardly at all, mostly because I felt like I couldn't speak for her, and I was really claustrophobic and caught in my own head, and I don't know, she had this other experience, and I didn't want to presume that I knew what it was, right? And he said, we need 5% more Jesse. And so a lot of the parts that people like best, and in the opera, actually, it's the parts with my wife. She humanizes the whole thing.
And how about you with the editing process? Because your book is, you know, shifts and moves. It kind of comes into itself through all kinds of different perspectives, all by you. But you know, you dip into history, you dip into all these different places, and then you still circle back into the epicenter of all this.
I had a similar sort of cycling or recycling or revisiting kind of motion, but I thought after that first chapter, then I decided to have 9 chapters, one for each muse, you know, so the 9 muses would be the construct.
Poets, man.
So I wrote this, yeah, right, so I wrote this entire book.
Oh yeah, I got that, totally.
Well, no.
The whole time.
No, then there was a version out there, and this gets back to that, if I put it in one sentence, it would be related to the first question. Then I realized that this is unreadable. This isn't working in a lot of ways. And so I ended up dropping entire chapters, and like that 90 pages that went to 22, now I had a book that was shifted back down and then had to re-expand. And,
right.
And then I took, before there was like one chapter was a 3-act play, one chapter was actually a collection of haibun, and then et cetera, et cetera. So each chapter had its own culture. And then I went back to that fundamental chapter. And I realized this chapter is doing something intriguing that I think I could learn from more than the others. The others were interesting, like artistic tries, you know, or experiments, but they weren't really getting to the things I needed, the cycling motion that I really wanted to explore. Yeah.
Did Horse Soldiers by Doug Stanton influence or heavily influence your work?
Is there a standard above heavily?
I would love. You know, I'd like to get a small reading from both of you because you talk about kind of your place in history, which I think is interesting because, you know, everyone kind of at some point has to reckon with that. You know, we're all here right now. There's been now before. There's going to be now again. But this is our now. And how do we relate to this chain of people, of this movement of humanity? Would you be so kind, Brian, why don't you start off first with a section?
I said infantry because I didn't really know if I could do it, if I could take it, if it would break me down and chew me up and then continue to keep on chewing. I said infantry because I knew that here is a portion of what work is. Here was a portion of what they fed to the lions in the dust and name of Rome. I said infantry because my great-grandfather Carter was gassed during the Battle of Moose Argonne in the fall of 1918, the bloodiest battle in American history. He was there in France during the First World War, and yet he still managed to crawl out through the ruined ground. The world rung into a gear-toothed roar, canisters of gas hissing as they flew over, and he made it back home, though the war would drag him under a few short years later. I said infantry because one of my great-greats enlisted in the Union Army at Cumberland Gap, Tennessee, and later served as a corporal in the Tennessee Volunteers. And even though he cracked his back on a green horse at Camp Dennison and later contracted rheumatic fever during a bitter December in Knoxville, he stayed on through the fight. From the Confederate horses shot in the river at Shelbyville and on to Huntsville, Alabama, from Bucktown Tavern to Powder Springs to the Siege of Atlanta. From the Battle of Franklin, the Battle of Nashville, and the pursuit of General John Bell Hood clear to the Tennessee River. I raised my hand and said the words, I swear, because I would have been ashamed in the years to come if I hadn't. Even if it didn't make sense, even if nobody I cared about ever thought about it, even if all the veterans in my family never said a word, or even if they did, saying, it's cool, Brian, it doesn't mean a thing, believe me, the uniform doesn't make the man. or anything along those lines, because it would have meant that between me and the people I revered most, there were beaches and jungle foliage and Russian MiGs and snipers and artillery craters and midnights spent drifting in the Pacific under the Southern Cross. Between me and the people I most revered, there were explosions I couldn't hear, curses and shouting and laughter, engines thrumming, Hueys and Blackhawks lifting from the grass and sand to map the earth, and medevac flights that would later deliver the wounded to gentle hands and latex gloves, surgeons calling for scalpels and sutures and more blood, type AB negative, while the airmen on the flight line hosed bodily fluids from the decks and drank coffee when the day was done.
What do you think when you leave the gate, when you leave the protective enclosure and false security of your ringed base? I thought of an uncle filling a C-130 with bullet holes over the tiny jungle airstrips in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. A grandfather who built the double runway on Guam in 1944. Another grandfather who landed in southern France and marched to Berlin. A great-great-grandfather, a lumberjack and pig farmer from North Pine Grove, Pennsylvania, fresh from the boat in the Kaiser's army, who at the age of 41, and with seven of his eventual nine children at home, left his plow in the field to march south with the 63rd Pennsylvania Volunteers to the Peninsula Campaign and the Second Battle of Bull Run. He returned 10 months later with a bullet hole and a Purple Heart. How would I return? Thoughts drift further as the dust in palm groves and empty desert landscape crawl by outside the thick windows of the armored truck. Does the thin line go back further? How far? What blood runs in my veins? Am I from a line of old? What may rise in me, unbidden and unknown, to meet this oldest of challenges? How many battlefields has my blood made wet, and empires made and gone, on bare green islands and cold forested mountains of myth, and lands whose names have changed countless times? How many arrows have I dodged? How many rifles have hung from my shoulder? How many bandages have I wrapped? How many helmets have I worn in the line of my people all the way back to the beginning? What resides hidden in me, lying in wait to be revealed, once the cycle continues and renews?
Yeah. Don't you find it interesting that those two passages exist in two entirely different thinking writers?
I promise you that we didn't read each other's stuff either, I guess.
His came
and
up first.
I kind of do the same thing in my own. What that doesn't speak to is the other side of what happens. You know, that blends some of the romance and history of all of our progression as families. But did you read anything before Iraq that was destroyed by the truth of war when you got there? Is there any particular passage or poems or books that you were like, this is something I need to participate in? And then you get there and you're delivered the full palette of what it really is. Yeah. And you go, how could I have willingly gone forward thinking that this was somehow something I needed to do?
You know, I'm not one to ban books, you know what I mean? And I believe in the freedom of the voice to participate in the full round of the circle that we've gathered for centuries, one voice after another, one story at a time. I believe in that. But at the same time, I can never do this again. You know, in the house, when you look through the bookshelves and you're looking for that book, the one I won't find is by Rupert Brooke. I won't find his books on my shelves anymore.
You know? Interesting. How about you?
You know, there's this tradition, American military tradition, since, World War I and in the poets, or although that started with the Brits, of course. It's certainly in Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22 and the things they carried, and we could go on and on. It's the American story is the American wants to go, and both of our passages were about before going, right? It's how it's what you wonder about yourself before you go. And then you go and you come back and you've learned something terrible. That's the American military story. There are, you know, there's a book like, I think it's called Reign of Steel. It's a German book about World War I, which basically, it's the antithesis of All Quiet on the Western Front. It's the you know, yes, there's this terrible war, and look at all of the wonderful glory in it. And despite all these things that happen, it maintains that. That doesn't make sense to me. I should also say, though, that like entire classes of American literature don't make sense to me anymore. Things like, I don't know, finding the drama in, Updike finds all this drama in infidelity and all that, you know, it's like the central theme of lots of his writing. I'm like, you know, I just can't find the drama in that. The things that I've put my wife through, I don't know, things about loyalty and everything else, I guess that's what sticks with me. All that stuff just doesn't rise to the occasion quite the same way. It seems to be lots of navel gazing, and we're just kind of like stuck in our own circle instead of, you know.
Not navy.
Yes, no.
Terms out there. Joe has put up with me an awful lot. He's in the back. He does all the sound work here and sets the entire stage up for us. And now I've already forgotten exactly which musical note I had queued up at first. But is it the Brian Turner playing bass in a rock band? Brian, can you speak to this for a moment before we play?
Well, one of the great pleasures I have is tinged with a deep sadness, and that is that a band, since I was about 7 years old, probably my biggest artistic influence was a man named Brian Voigt, who was really like closer to me than my brother was. And he died in December of 2012 of stomach cancer. And he was a guitar player in the band I played in. You won't hear him, except maybe just a little bit in the very back if you've got a tuned ear. But he, in the back of the memoir, there's a link to a song so you can hear. And actually, you can go to the website and listen to a song. And it feels like this book is a chance to, in some way, also bring him back so that his music can be enjoyed in some way. This is me playing. Do you want the technical stuff?
Back to zero. Is it true that you took poetry classes in order to write better lyrics for your rock band?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Who does that?
Actually, quite a few people. I was at Fresno State. I had hair halfway down my back. Used to wear a little skeleton earring. Played bass. You know, he's a drummer. Also, I don't know if you know that. But.
That's great. I'm excited. Let's hear a little bit of Brian.
Sure. Thanks. For those guys.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Stay tuned for more from authors Brian Kastner and Brian Turner.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Benjamin Bush's conversation with Brian Kastner and Brian Turner.
And for a few, before I knew Brian, I'd read Here Bullet, and I'd read it in my voice. I hadn't read it in the way he actually reads his poetry. And so I'd like you to come read a poem in the way that I forever will hear your poetry now, if you'd like to go up and talk to the big chair. It's transformational, and I think it's interesting when you hear a poet especially read their own work in their own voice with their placement of importance on words, with the power they intended for it to be heard in, it's a great opportunity, so.
And this one, Brian, it's thinking of you as well here. Katusha rockets. The 107s have a crackling sound of fire and electricity, of air-ruckled heat, And when they pinwheel of the rooftops of Haman al-Alil, they just keep going, traveling for years over the horizon to land in the meridians of Divisadero Street, where I'm standing early one morning on a Memorial Day in Fresno, California. The veterans parade scattering at the impact, mothers shielding their children by instinct, old war vets crouching behind automobiles as police set up an outer cordon for the unexploded ordnance. Rockets often fall in the night sky of the skull. Down long avenues of the brain's myelin sheathing, over synapses and the rough structures of thought, they fall into the hippocampus, into the seat of memory, where lovers and strangers and old friends entertain themselves, unaware of the dangers headed their way. Or that I will need to search among them the way the bomb disposal tech walks tethered and alone down to Divisadero Street, suited up as if walking on this moon's surface, as a crowd watches just how determined he is to dismantle death, to take it apart piece by piece, the bravest thing I've ever seen.
And now I always have his voice in my head. And I worry about putting his voice on other things that I read. And I'm beginning to give him credit for everything that I read, because I like his, I love reading his work. Here Bullet was the first poem I ever heard by Brian Turner, and it made me afraid. I thought I was going to get shot. It's one of those really explosive poems. But I hadn't read it that way. I read it straight up and kind of cold. And that's the amazing thing sometimes. About words. Do you have favorite words? Do you like collect them like I do? Like, hey, I'm gonna use this someday because it's just a great word.
There was one in that poem, actually. I love the word ruckled.
Ruckled, which I've never used. Yeah.
My favorite word is oubliette.
What?
Oubliette, and I thought I worked it in. I did a review of Hassan Blossom's book, Corpse Exhibition, for NPR, and I snuck it in there. And the producer said, we don't say oubliette on NPR. like it's a curse word or something.
Right.
And they said, can you use another word? And I said, a dark hole from which there is no escape. And they said, yeah, that's good. And then they said, okay, this piece is too long. We need to cut 3 seconds. And I said, okay, can we put oubliette back in? You know, but you don't say oubliette on the radio.
No.
So yes, that's my someday. I'll work in oubliette.
How about words you hate? Like, there's certain words I will never in my life use. I will never use the word winningest.
Well, that's terrible.
It's terrible. But someone came up with it, and they use it in sports all the time. So I have, like, this list. Like, I will quote someone as saying, that's still legal for me, because it's not me saying it. I'm quoting somebody, even if it's fiction. But I won't reuse it in prose. Like, I won't even use a word like copacetic, because it just feels like antiseptic. It feels like, you know, it feels like a cure for something that itches. But down south, you know, it means like, you know, it's cool. I whenever I hear the word, I just imagine Matthew McConaughey saying, you know.
Yeah.
That's copacetic.
Yeah, that's good.
It's all right. It's cool. Do you have words like that that make you twitch a little bit? And
I don't use the word pedantic because I don't think you can use it without being it. So that one
bam.
I skip permanently. I guess.
I don't know about words, but I have like two phrases or two. There's one is price point. I just don't like hearing that, you know? Mm-hmm. Can you just say, how much does it cost? You know?
Right.
Price point just seems fancy, or at least a little bit of embellishment on it. And the other thing I don't like, and I'm hoping we can maybe start changing, is it's not so much the phrase, but it's that there isn't, it's opposite. And that is, you guys hear this all the time? You know, she's the most independent woman I know. Yeah, I hate that.
She's the most independent.
You never hear, so I want to start saying, let's just start saying, you know, that Turner, he's the most independent man I know. You know? When have you heard that?
I hear a lot. Because my wife is the most independent woman I know. But, followed twice by my daughters who are, they think they're independent. Yeah, I hate double words like non-starter and no-brainer. They make my head hurt. When I you know, write them out, you know. How about jingoism?
Jingoism, yeah.
That's something we should be talking about because, you know, patriotism is kind of the yelling of war, but jingoism, it sounds, once again, like I should be treated for that, you know?
Right.
Hey, Doc, I don't want to talk about it in the the waiting room, but I have a little case of jingoism. Have you got some copacetic for that? how do you guys deal with those words when you see them? Are there things that offend you in other writing, or do you kind of just glass it over and go, well, that's a way of saying it?
I don't know. I try to let go. I try to, I don't know. I guess I don't get quite, I don't get quite as bothered, but I think your point is sound. Katie Schultz, who I think that we know, she wrote a great book called Flashes of War. She has no military background. She wrote this really true war story by sitting in her cabin in North Carolina and just thinking about it. And she said the reason that she got into it is because she realized words like patriotism, speaking of that, had come to take on a different meaning. And she, I don't know, she thought that was worth exploring when we use a word that used to mean one thing and now it's turned into meaning something else. And
contractor or... Right. When you carry a weapon, not somebody who teaches something or fixes something, but someone. When we hire them, they're contractors. With somebody else, it's a mercenary.
Yeah. Some people call the military mercenaries.
A sanction when you're flying over paid. Bombing people.
How about military terms? When you talk about words that get transformed into bizarre collections of English abuse. Like it's just they just abuse the language in horrible ways in the military sometimes by kind of. These two words are going to mean all the stuff we want to say, and we're going to put it on boxes and MREs. Are there any military terms you heard wow, I've never really?
Yeah, right off the bat is in the Army, and there's different hua, which means everything. You can use it in any hua, 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 hua. There's many more variations. Those are just some. So you can,
But I'm talking about an actual word.
No, that's a word in the military. That and the F word. Those two combined is basically the vocabulary of the grunt.
Yeah. So we use hooyah is also the same kind of thing. Hand me that hooyah, and it's just whatever you're looking at.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't have time to say wrench.
I prefer the Navy way where everything is a hooyah, and it really does make things much easier.
Plane, tank, all hooyahs.
I think actually the best one in the EOD bomb squad world is when things explode, we say they come from together. I don't know, it's actually kind of poetic as well.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, if it's one we like, then I like it's a significant emotional event. Yeah. That's when you have the shit scared out of you. It's a significant emotional event.
Or if you have to take a shit, it's a gross weight adjustment.
Right. Like that, well, that 107 that I just talked about in that poem going over, that was right under that category.
Yeah, gross weight adjustment. You either drop a bomb, it's your plane dropping a bomb, or I have to go to the head and take a dump. You write narrative poetry. How was that, which is one way of each one of your poems is a little story. How was it kind of transferring from writing with that sense of crystalline language where you're using the fewest words possible to writing prose where all your pages got equally wide, all your sentences had to go from one side to the other and stack up with some kind of regularity versus the ability to work in free verse. How was that for you?
I enjoy it. And I enjoyed it, and I continue to enjoy it. It's.
I preferred if you were suffering. That was
hard. Well, I do, as I realize, because the reason is it feels like the poem, feels like the stanza, I was talking earlier today, the stanza, the root of that in Italian means room, at least one of the derivations. And room by room, stanza by stanza, you sort of construct these vehicles, these spaces. And when I was in combat writing Here Bullet, in that poem that I wrote, that I just read, it seemed like it was the right vehicle rather than a long narrative, because I couldn't find a sense of continuity. Continuity was boredom, punctuated by this bizarre, difficult event where it was 2 seconds or 36 hours, and then back to boredom again. So the poem seemed like the right vehicle for that. But then when I came home and over the years trying to figure out generationally even if prose feels like the walls are sort of knocked down. And you have this wide landscape, a wide canvas, to sort of look at the connections both on the field of our time, but then also the deep history that we stand upon.
That's fascinating. Do you guys have any writing habits? Let's start with you. Like things you kind of do. Do you wear latex gloves? Do you put on a beard?
Yes, I do.
Do you only write in the rain when you can cry? How do you kind of go, okay, I'm going to sit down in this room and transfer a world onto all.
I'm kind of fussy about it. It takes me, I need prolonged, persistent exposure to it. So I can't sit down and write for 30 minutes. I need 6 hours. And I spend the first 3 hours remembering the voice of the work that I'm in. And then I manage to write some other stuff kind of at the end. And I have this crutch where I still run a lot. I run 15, 20 miles a week if I can. And I do all my writing in my head while I run. And then as soon as I get into the computer, I scribble everything down, handwrite it, and then it's just a matter of remembering all that. But I think it was Hemingway talks in his Paris Review interview about always end in the middle so you know where to start the next day. And I think there's something to that, but I reread. You know, if I'm writing a chapter, I start at the beginning of the chapter every time, and I read through the chapter, and I edit, write a little more. Then the next day, edit, write a little more. And so that way, you hopefully get something coherent.
Interesting. Right? Reviews, we all get reviews. Do you guys have anything from reviews that have kind of stuck with you? Either they've been hilarious, misplaced, or kind of baffling? Because you get those. It's someone else examining your work from a different perspective, which of course is healthy, unless they don't get your work. Anything come to mind from your years of people saying, I read your book, take it back, you know?
I've had several things. One was disturbing, the poem Pure Bullet, for example. Just that poem. Somebody read it, and I guess on a blog, was talking about suicide and saying, Turner gets it, because if it was promoting that or and it's nowhere near the field of, and I have a wide sort of open space where I think a poem can land, and I felt like that was not anywhere near where I wanted to be with that. And I've had to others where, like with the current book, this one guy quoted a line talking about, and there's a passage that talks about mortuary affairs school where we're learning about these dead bodies, and they had some of us lay in the grass, and he was telling us about how you put flags near them to mark them and that kind of thing. And I had a descriptive line that talked about the blades of grass, which is a nod to Whitman, right? And the line I thought was, I tried to make it beautiful and artful, talking about sort of the translucent nature of the light going through the grass, illuminating its sort of infinite nature or something. It's different phrasing, but, and then he quoted that line and said, huh? and I kind of felt like, it's saying the body's here, the grass. It didn't seem that hard to get.
A lot of the initial reviews that came out all said that my book was raw and earnest, which I've now learned since is code for needed editing, naive, didn't know what he was, half-baked, should have had more time in.
And we disagreed on that.
We've talked about this and disagree. There was one review that started off with, when I got this book, my thought was just what we need, another crazy book from another crazy vet. And in some ways, I don't know, that was exactly the point. I felt like I was turning into a stereotype and a caricature of myself and the crazy vet, and I used the word for a reason, and I was trying to move through that and past that. It ended up being a better review by the end, but if you just read the first sentence, it's another crazy book by another crazy vet.
I got one that said, hated it, that's all.
Fair enough.
And so I checked to see what it was a Goodreads thing, and all they read were, fantasy horror stuff, and they thought Dust to Dust was obviously a vampire book.
Oh, right.
which would have disappointed them, in truth. Let's go back to Jesse. This is amazing thing is, Brian Kastner's book has been turned into an opera. It's going to be happening. I'm going. Yeah, it's going to be in Saratoga in the spring. Do you think it would be cool if we listened to a little piece of it? It's still being developed, so this is kind of an early stage. But could we listen to a little piece of your wife, or the character of your wife singing?
Yes, Opera Jesse. We've got Heather Johnson sings my wife, and Danny Belcher sings me, and we've started to refer to them as Opera Brian and Opera Jesse, and they've become good friends, actually. So we've got a little piece. The opera opens One great thing about the opera is they took, there are things that work way better in the opera than work in the book, and one of them is Jessie is a fully realized character, and her struggle with the family, I think, is actually the narrative line that moves the opera through. And she opens the opera, and I think we're going to listen to the very beginning of Jessie's aria. And if you've read the book, you know that one of the things that I put in there was, when I first deployed, Jessie went to her grandmother and said, how do I deal with Brian coming home, looking for some of this World War II advice? And her grandmother's response was, well, Brian's never going to come home. He's going to die over there, or he's going to come home a different person. And that's the frame that that's how the opera opens. So that's what we're going to.
That's incredibly powerful. Joe, if you would be so kind.
I should say, this is the workshop, so it's guitar, piano, and voice, and then it'll be in full orchestration next summer. Heather's amazing.
It must be amazing to see it transform so much. I would love to hear you both read one more passage, kind of a longer passage from your books, that kind of let us feel a little bit more what they're about, if you'd be so kind.
Okay, here we go. This is about one of the jobs I did oftentimes was it seemed like for months, was kicking in people's doors and raiding their homes. The soldiers enter the house. The soldiers enter the house. Soldiers, determined and bored and searing with adrenaline, enter the house with shouting and curses and muzzle flash, det cord and 5.56 millimeter ball ammunition. The soldiers enter the house with pixelated camouflage, flex cuffs, chem lights, door markings, duct tape. The soldiers enter the house with ghillie suits and Remington sniper rifles, Phoenix beacons and night vision goggles, lasers invisible to the naked eye, rotor blades, hellfire missiles, bandoliers strapped across their chests. They enter the house one fire team after another, and they fight brutal, dirty, nasty, the only way to fight. The soldiers enter the house with the flag of their nation sewn on the sleeves of their uniforms. They enter the house with Toledo and Baton Rouge imprinted on the rubber soles of their desert combat boots. They enter the house and shout, "Honey, I'm home, and here's Johnny." Soldiers enter the house with conversations of Monday Night Football and the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. They enter the house with obscenities rolling off their tongues. They enter the house with paperbacks in their cargo pockets, Starship Troopers and Black Hawk Down, "We were soldiers once and young." The soldiers enter the house straight out of Compton or with Eminem saying, "Look, if you had one shot or one opportunity." They enter the house with their left foot. They enter the house the way one enters cemeteries or unclean places. They enter the house with their insurance policies filled out, signed, beneficiaries named, last will and testament sealed in manila envelopes half a world away. They enter the house having just ordered a new set of chrome mufflers on eBay for the Mustang stored under blankets in a garage north of San Francisco. They enter the house with only 9 credits earned toward an associate's degree in history from the University of Maryland. They kick in the door and enter the house with the memory of backyard barbecues on their minds. They kick in the door while cradling their little sisters in their arms. They kick in the door and pull in the toboggans and canoes from the hillsides and lakes of Minnesota. They kick in the door and bring in the horses from the barn, hitching them kitchen table inside. The soldiers enter the house with Mrs. Ingram from second grade at Villain Elementary School and Mrs. Garupa from Madera High. They kick in the door and enter the house with their arms filled with all the homework they ever did and sit down to consider the quadratic equation, the Socratic method. The soldiers enter the house to sit cross-legged on the floor as the family inside watches on, watches how the soldiers interrogate them, saying, how do I say the word for friend in Arabic? How do I say the word love? How do I tell you that Private Miller is dead, that Private Miller has holes in the top of his head? What is the word for ghosts in Arabic? And how many live here? And are the ghost bath party supporters? Are the ghosts here with us now? Can you tell us where the ghosts are hiding? And where the ghosts keep their weapons cache? And where they sleep at night? And what can you tell us about Alibaba? Is there an Alibaba in the neighborhood? The soldiers enter the house and take off their dusty combat boots and pull out an anthology of poetry from an assault pack, Iraqi Poetry Today, and commence reading poems aloud. The soldiers say, this is war then, all is well. They say, the missiles bomb the cities and the airplanes bid the clouds farewell. The soldiers remove their flak vests and turn off their radios. They smile and stretch their arms, one of them yawning, another asking for a second cup of chai. The soldiers give chocolates to the frightened little children in the shadows of the house. The soldiers give chocolates to the frightened little children and teach them how to say f*** you and how to flip off the world. The soldiers recite poetry as trays of chai and tea and cigarettes are brought into the room. The soldiers, there in the candlelight of the front room, with the Iraqi men of military age, zip-tied with flex cuffs, kneeling, sandbags over their heads, read verses from Iraqi Poetry Today. The soldiers switch off their night vision goggles and set their padded helmets on the floor while the frightened little children pretend to eat the chocolates they've been given, their mothers shushing them when they begin to cry. And the soldiers, men from Kansas and California, Tacoma and College Station, these soldiers remove the gloves from their hands to show the frightened little children how they mean them no harm, how American the soldiers are, how they might bring in a pitcher of water for the bound and blinded men to drink from soon, perhaps if there's time, and how they read poetry for them, their own poetry in English, saying, between time and time, between blood and blood, all is well. All is well, the soldiers say. The soldiers kick in the doors and into the house and zip-tie the men of military age and shush the women and the frightened little children and drink the spoon sugar stirred into the hot chai and remove their stinking boots and take off their flak vests and stack their weapons and turn off their night vision goggles and say to the frightened little children softly with their palms held out in the most tender of gestures they can offer, their eyes as brown as the hills that lead to the mountains or as blue as the rivers that lead to the sea, saying, all is well, little ones, all is well.
I'm so glad Brian read that. I've heard him read it a couple times now, and it's by far my favorite section from My Life as a Foreign Country. I just think it's amazing. I wanted to say very quickly before I read my passage, this is actually my second trip to Traverse City. I was here almost 3 years ago, unfortunately, to put one of my brothers in the ground. Matthew Schwartz was who I've discovered is there are still memorials and fundraisers and everything else. For Matthew, he was a very good friend of mine. He and Jenny and the girls were stationed with my wife and I. They're people very, very important to us. And when we came almost 3 years ago, now up to Traverse City, the day of the funeral, and it's about 3 degrees, and it was about a 7-mile drive from the church to the cemetery, and all of Traverse City was lined up the entire way, waving and holding signs. It was very important to the brotherhood that was there. So thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm happier to come back under much better circumstances. My section that I'm going to read, all you need to know is that an IED has gone off, and I fell to the ground, and the Iraqi police had been shooting at it and trying to take it apart before they got there, and we sent in the robot, and it was a concrete block, and we tried to lift it, and the thing detonated. When the IED detonated 20 yards away, it tore the 400-pound robot to pieces, mangled it beyond recognition, leaving only the rear stump of an amputated arm and a single set of knobby tracks behind. The blast set molten metal fire and jagged rock in all directions, blowing out the windows and tires of the soft-skinned Iraqi police trucks and peppering the broadside of our armored Humvee. Keener and Mengerhausen, two guys on my team, were safe from the frag in the truck. Castleman had taken cover behind the engine block when he recognized the danger of the fake trigger mechanism. By luck or unconscious habit, I had kept the bulk of the Humvee's cab between me and the IED. Only my shins and the top of my head were exposed. I calmly patted down my legs and boots and was amazed to find no blood. I tried to stand and found myself only slightly steadier. All about me, our security was suddenly energized, the platoon sergeant barking orders for his turn gunners to wake up and scan rooftops for gunmen. The Iraqi police huddled to the side, confused, except for the weaselly mustache detective who had cut off the hoax black box. He waved his arms in the air and wailed that he was stupid and suicidal and would never walk up to a bomb again. I raised my rifle to my cheek and looked through my optics across the river and into the slums. The sight picture bounced violently. I checked my grip and my arm placement. Every muscle remembered where to go. Why can't I get a steady shot? I lashed onto the rifle tighter, but I still couldn't settle it. I took a deep breath, just as I was taught, and tried again. The red dot danced from riverbed to sky. "Hey, Captain, you okay?" called Castleman, checking in, confirming the safety of the team. "Yeah, I'm good," I called back. "You sure?" he said again, and he pointed to my leg. I looked down. My left leg was bucking and shaking uncontrollably, twitching like a dead animal in its throes. I willed my leg to be still, but it was possessed, and the wild spasms continued unabated. No wonder I couldn't shoot and could barely stand. As the physical symptoms of the coursing adrenaline took over, my veins began to boil. Detachment yielded to anger, shock to bloodlust. I raised my rifle and scanned rooftops again, but smartly, no silhouettes remained after the detonation. I wanted a target, somewhere to vent my frustration and powerlessness, but none appeared. The weapons of our security stayed quiet too, and an odd silence settled as it became clear that the booby trap was not a signal for an ambush. "I'm going down," announced Castleman. "Someone has to clear it, and we don't have another robot. Get the bomb suit, put it on me. I'm doing the search for secondaries alone. The long walk, armor on, girded with breastplate and helm and leggings and collar, 80 pounds of mailed Kevlar. No one can put on the bomb suit alone. Your brother has to dress you. Overalls pulled up, massive jacket tucked, earnest in its careful thoughtfulness. One last check, face shield down, and then into the breach alone. Though there is no more direct confrontation of wills between bomber and EOD technician than the long walk. Donning the suit, living behind rifle and security to outwit your opponent nose to nose. The lonely seeking of hidden danger to ensure no more hazards lie in wait to snatch the next soldier to pass that way, the next EOD brother or sister, the next local shopkeeper or taxi driver or child playing in a garbage-laden sewer. No one takes the long walk lightly. Only after every other option is extinguished, only after robots fail and resources dwindle, the last choice always. But when the choice comes, when the knife's edge between folly and reason finally tips, training affords a decisiveness to guide your higher purpose. Castleman went so Keener didn't have to, so Mengerhausen didn't have to, so I didn't have to. You take the long walk for your brother's wife, your brother's children, and their children, and the line unborn. No greater love does one brother have for another than to take the long walk. Thank you.
That was Brian Kastner and Brian Turner talking with Benjamin Bush. Brian Kastner's book is called The Long Walk. Brian Turner wrote My Life as a Foreign Country. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Melkerich.